work at Conversant centers around conversation as the highest leverage place to focus if you want to improve the quality of your relationships, your work, and any collaborative effort that matters to you. It sounds simple, but in practice, getting great at reliably having high-quality conversations can be incredibly challenging. It's challenging because people are challenging. We come up against differences of opinion or perspective, different beliefs and values, and the dissonance can feel impossible to rectify. As human beings, we have a tendency to double down on our side of the disagreement, as if winning the argument and being right was more important than anything else we could possibly achieve together. Within our work community, we have decades and decades of experience studying and coaching the art and science of conversation. And while it's a complex area of focus, there are a few essential things that, if commonly practiced, would dramatically shift our personal and working relationships. Today, we dig into one of those essential principles, practicing accuracy. Accuracy is defined by Merriam-Webster as free from error, especially as the result of care. Conversationally, we really are placing the emphasis on care here, caring enough to come as close to a capital T truth as we can, while respecting that the truth of any given situation lies in the space between us. You have information that I don't have, and vice versa. We may see some things the same way and other things differently. Together, we get a more complete picture of reality. In conversation, accuracy is all about acknowledging that my opinion or perspective is not reality on its own. It's about recognizing that as human beings, we come up with explanations and stories that make sense of the information we have available to us. And those stories may or may not necessarily be true. If we're being accurate, seeking to be as free from error as possible, we're exploring all the different explanations we have available to us, asking others in the situation to offer theirs as well. With all those cards on the table, which ones help us and what we care about, and which ones hurt? Most of us walk around with thoughtless certainty that our view, what we perceive, is the whole story. The best of us, though, the ones that generate new understanding and possibilities by connecting the dots we all have to offer, leverage the differences of what we see and turn it into value. All it takes is shifting how we listen and what we're listening for. Again, sounds simple, tough in practice, but with practice, it does get easier, and your work and your relationships will be better for it. So please enjoy today's episode, which invites you to decide, is it more important to be right, or is there something we can build together? Welcome back to On Connection. I'm joined once again by Robin and Mickey. Hello, hello. Say hello.
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 Today, we wanted to spend some time on a key part of some of the fundamentals of what we think contribute to conversational value, collaboration, your ability to improve the quality of your relationships, all of that. If you've worked with us before, you know that a basic distinction that we make is that all conversations produce either value or waste. And the value piece, we say that the quality of your listening is really what's driving whether or not you're generating value in any given conversation or relationship. And we say the test for listening is learning. However, to bridge the gap from the I'm listening from a wasteful place to I'm listening from a learning and valuable generating place can be a big one for people. And so we wanted to spend some dedicated time on that tipping point for value. And well, I'll leave it at that. What all would you also like to prime us with in terms of why this conversation matters and or why you think people get stuck in that split from the edge of waste to the edge of value?
Well, I think we'll probably explore this a little more deeply in a moment, but I'm just going to start with, I think too often people are using conversation as a tennis match more than they are conversation as a construction activity. I'm in the middle of construction in my home. So maybe that's why that analogy feels right to me. But the construction, what I mean by that is tennis match mean I say something, you say something, I say something, you say something, sort of volley back and forth, hoping that somehow or other something will be resolved, or I'll convince you to see the world my way, or you'll convince me to see the world the way you do, as opposed to construction, which is building. Can we each put something into it together and start to see what emerges as we do that? So that's what I think is really, what's my intention in the conversation? Is it to try to get you to do a thing, air quotes, get you to do a thing, or is it for us to arrive someplace together?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a beautiful context for this. The difference between, I'm in a conversation, my question is who's winning, versus my conversation is what are we building?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful way to think of this. And the deeply ingrained desire to prove I'm right and that those who don't agree, those varlets, those villains, to prove them wrong and do it as graciously as I can. I really want to be civilized about proving what an idiot you are.
Well, and if you listened to our last episode prior to this one, we talked about resolving conflict. And this is sort of a deeper dive into some of the principles that would help in that scenario. So anytime there's a difference of opinion, but we also just want to focus explicitly on, where is there something that you care to create more value within? So whether that's relationships at work, relationships at home, whatever the context is, maybe it's collaboration with your team, cross-team collaboration, anywhere that you think more value would be a good thing and something that you care about. We do have, if you are new to us, a handy dandy tool that we call the conversation meter that's helpful for assessing where you are in your listening and how that's generating either value or waste. We're not going to go into the depth of all of that today, but we'll link some things in the show notes for you to reference in order for you to learn about how to use that tool. But today we want to focus more on what we call accuracy. So what does it mean to be accurate in conversation in service of generating value? Accuracy is a word that gets thrown around a lot, and we find that people might draw their own assumption about what we mean by that word. So what do we mean when we say accuracy? What are we asking people to be conscious of?
Well, I think we need to be conscious of it in the context of another word.
Okay.
Which is authenticity.
Okay, great.
So those of you who know the conversation meter know that we say that the part of it that's about generating value is based in accuracy and authenticity. We could do a whole other deep dive into this notion of authenticity. For now, part of it that matters is, if what we care about is what we're building, then we need to both be conscious of what are we building together. So the authentic nature of our relationship is, what do we both care about that explains why we're even talking to each other? You know, what matters to us mutually? So we say the source of teamwork is a common future. All right, well, one of the aspects of authenticity is, what do we both really, honestly, genuinely care about that we are willing to come together in care of and service of? So that's the answer to, what are we building, that thing? So at least that much, MRO, is, I think, of authenticity, of saying what is important to us both that we're in this conversation to address, to help with, to build on, to serve. Then we get into, what's accuracy do to help with that?
Mm-hmm. One quick thing on that before we move into accuracy. MRO, as you said this a minute ago about building with your team or building across teams. Mm-hmm. The thing that Mickey just said here, I think, is one of the challenges in building across teams is we lose sight of the thing that we mutually care about, because inside of our own team, we get really protective of the thing that our team is out to accomplish, mm-hmm. forgetting that we're actually trying to accomplish that in service of something else for the organization. Mm-hmm. And so the number of places where we see that organizationally, I didn't say this, somebody else, I don't remember who, among us said that organizations are actually not set up well for finding authentic intersection. So if we think about how organizations in are particularly for-profit, although you see it a lot in nonprofit as well, the way they're structured, right, where you have functional structures, where people inside those functional structures tend to care about something, and that's how they're organized. And now we're asking them to also care about something that's bigger than just that one slice. And I think, Mick, this is what makes getting to that authenticity so challenging, is actually having to set down the thing that feels really close. Financial management. Financial management is certainly an element of all of our life inside of organizations. And it's not the only thing, right? And so it's really, how do you care for the financial management and for the marketing or the brand at the same time? And those two things can often feel like there's just innate conflict between them. And I picked those two randomly, any of the organizational silos. And so, Mick, this thing you just said, I think, is really critical. And I didn't want it to go by too fast, about we got to find the thing that we all really do care about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just as an example, some of you know, we have a lot of respect for Bruce Broussard and his team at Humana. And one of the things that they arrived at, this is, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago now, life keeps going by more quickly than I give it permission, is that they really saw the honorable, the genuine purpose that really drove their commercial success is helping people live a greater percentage of their lives well. So if we could help people achieve lifelong well-being, that's great for people's lives, and it's good for us being a profitable enterprise. Mm-hmm. Well, when they announced that as the purpose that really was going to be the source of their commercial success in the next era of Humana, whenever this was, a dozen years ago, that changed what people came together for. Mm-hmm. So finance is in this conversation, and marketing's in this conversation, sales is in this conversation, and how are all of us contributing to people living a greater percentage of their lives healthy? I mean, that was really something. So what made it authentic is it actually became the way they were running the company, and people had to redefine themselves in terms of that. Mm-hmm. So then, what was the accuracy in their everyday conversations that helped them do that? But the first thing is, we got to find something we're building to fit with Robin's metaphor.
Well, and what's good about what you both just set up is that it's, how do we get from I'm protecting whatever I care about and protecting my ability to achieve that goal or be seen in that way or be held with regard or whatever the thing is? How do you get from there to being present to and working in service of the thing that we're in together? So how do we work towards serving a common goal and a common future rather than my thing, whether that's me, my team in my silo, or me as an individual in my life? So how do we get there? What's the bridge from defending your side of the street to being in partnership with others?
Well, I'm going to do the very short version of the last 35 years in response to that. The key is enlarging the issue. And what I mean by that is, you start out, let's say if there's two people and you're trying to figure out, what are we building? Okay, well, we both work in this organization, or we both have reason to talk to each other because of this nonprofit we're both contributing to, or whatever is the reason we're talking to each other. The question for each person, for you, what's important about this? And then as you get, so Emma, as you say A is important to you, and Robin says B, and I say C, well, one of us has got to look at, well, what's the larger thing that all three of those actually are a part of? So it's not about leaving my issue for your issue. That's where people get stuck.
Right.
Yeah. I've got to trade in my importance for your importance. No. What's the important thing in which those are each components? Mm-hmm. And if people learn to do that, it stops feeling like I'm giving something up.
Right.
No, mm-hmm. I'm actually finding my place in a larger issue. And you can find your place in there too. Now let's look at how we put these together to make that happen.
And I think accurate conversations are actually an essential move to make in order to find that, particularly when it is not inherently obvious. Because there are going to be places where you've lost sight of the thing that you're all in together, or the only thing you can name is, well, we have the same company on our paycheck. And maybe that's actually too broad to actually resolve the issue that's at hand. But accurate conversations actually enable us to start to really do the research that we need to understand what are we each contributing. And so, Emerose, the other thing you said in there is, well, what do we do? And can the way I often say this is, can I put my own point of view down momentarily? I'm not, to Mickey, to your point, I'm not abandoning it. I'm not letting it go. I'm not leaving it by the roadside. I'm just saying, can I loosen my grip on it momentarily to really listen to what someone else has to say and learn from them about their perspective, what matters to them, how they see a particular issue. And it's hard to do. So this is why we say 10 minutes to learn and a lifetime to master, and to look at it with fresh eyes and not just through the lens of what I already think I know.
Right. Well, I think you just used a really important word, at least how I feel oriented in this distinction, is about perception. So a big mental switch from defending my point of view, my side of the street, to seeing this bigger picture is, can I acknowledge that my perception isn't reality? So just because I see something a particular way doesn't mean that I am the sole owner of the truth. It might be the only truth I can see or that I'm present to, unless I go and talk to another person and get a different vantage point in which I get to learn from the bigger picture of the situation, right? So there are things that, acknowledging that I don't know and see everything about this thing, and I need your perspective in order to be able to better see it, which that can feel hard for people, because that is an act of releasing your grip on your version of reality, which can be quite disruptive and a little scary, especially if you do feel like it's important. If it's really, really important to you, it's definitely challenging to do.
Well, and my version of reality is the way I'm currently explaining something that has happened, or a set of facts or information that I have available. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying here is, can I see alternate explanations? And is there another one that might give us a different way forward than the one that we're currently stuck inside of?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, that is an art of exploration. And it also requires, Robin, what you said earlier about, can I put down my impassioned defense of my view for a moment, not leave it, not abandon it. I'm just going to put it in this little relaxed spot next to me, completely accessible when I'm ready to pick it back up, mm-hmm. and understand what you're saying. What have you experienced that has you say that? Because there's a whole lot of discovery that upgrades the conversation. So I want to go into that for a minute, Emerose, because when we talk about accuracy, often what comes up is, how do you know a fact's a fact, and what you say a fact, and what I say is a fact, is not a fact? And yeah, it is a very hot topic, especially in our political discourse these days. And that's why this context that Robin's given us about what are we building together is so important here. So we're not here to resolve that, because if we were working there, that's the graduate level version of this, where you'd be having to get those people to arrive at what are they building together, rather than what am I destroying in you and what are you trying to destroy in me? Mm-hmm. So we're not there. We're saying there's got to be some possibility of building something together that is the basis for an accurate conversation. And then, as we are wont to say, the test for listening is learning, mm-hmm. which means when I run into a point of view that's not mine, I can't immediately understand. My job is to learn from it before I try to attack it, which I'm sure we've mentioned many times before. But in this case, what's the nature of a fact regarding accuracy? Well, a conversational test for fact is it's mutually verifiable. We both agree that's a fact. I can go check it, and I can base my understanding on something that I consider to be objective and verifiable, not just your opinion.
Well, and that we consider to be objective and verifiable, right?
That's right, right. But if it starts out, you say that, and then I go...
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, like... you know, we have times when we hear people say something about their background that's a fact, but people just weren't aware of. And the moment they hear it, all of a sudden, what they think of that person changes. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, really? You spent 4 years in either the Obama or Clinton administration? Mm-hmm. You know, which we know was true about Michelle Hunt. And the moment she says that, all of a sudden we're interested in what happened there. What did you learn there? How's that affect life today? So it's got to be an area that's available to discussion. And if it's not verifiable, the real question is, well, what facts do we endorse? And that's where people get messed up. They want to argue about the facts they can't immediately and mutually verify. Well, mm-hmm. no, stop and take a breath. Well, what facts do we both accept mm-hmm. regarding this thing we're building or this issue we're discussing or whatever? So that's one thing that's part of this art of discovery. Go to where we have common ground first, because mm-hmm. yeah. it gives us a place to stand together. Well, what's the nature of the common ground? One, what are we building? And two, what facts relative to that do we both endorse? Yeah, okay. Now we have a place to stand for the conversation, one that we're standing in together. And that is an asset to learning from one another. Because mm-hmm. then you're going to run into a lot of different things. But we say that the two primary distinctions in accuracy is fact and explanation. Now, explanations can come from very different sources. One source of an explanation is, it's my way of accounting for the facts. So it's a fact-based explanation. Another source of an explanation is some belief I have that I'm not willing to test with your facts or anybody else's facts. You know, I just believe this to be true. Now, if you look at deeply entrenched belief, do you think giving somebody a fact that argues with that belief changes the belief?
No.
As we would say, where I grew up, is highly unlikely that would happen. But you want to be aware of it. Oh, somebody's come into this with this conviction that's not available to conversation. All right, well, that's not the place that you share. But some people give up on the conversation because they find out, oh, on this issue, you're over in that zip code and I'm over in this zip code and those are in different states and they'll never meet. You know, you want to go back to the common spot. So when you run into deeply entrenched belief that conflicts, the question is, does that really matter to what we're building? Mm-hmm. Instead of getting distracted by, oh, we don't agree about that. Where do we agree? What can we care about together? Then another kind of explanation is actually prejudice. Where it's not even based in a long-held belief. It's just thoughtless, unexamined opinion. That, too, can derail a conversation. But prejudice and deep, unavailable-to-be-discussed conviction are not the power that's going to move the conversation forward. what moves it forward? It's explanations that fit the facts that we both care about. And then inside of that distinction of explanation, the question is, which explanation helps us deal with those facts? Which explanations do nothing to help us? And which explanations hurt us dealing with those facts? That's the learning ground. That's where, I mean, learning how to explain, it is a powerful part of accuracy. How do we interpret facts? How do we learn from each other's interpretation of the facts? What do you think that means? Oh, I never thought about it meaning that. So, Robin, yeah, I know this is an area you care about deeply, so.
Well, you know, I think we've said this before. I have an engineering degree. I actually did engineering work for a decade or so of my life, and I was also an analyst for another 5 or 6 years on top of that. And so when you put all that together, what I found in that time and what I find in our work that I have to be thoughtful about when we talk about accuracy is people think if you introduce a fact, you are automatically being accurate according to our definition. And I would say that's not what we mean. So if you, because you'll hear lots of people who want to use facts, and I'm using that language very particularly, use facts to win their case or make their case or win it. That is not actually what we mean by being accurate. Here we really do mean, can you pull apart the facts and the explanations for those facts? What I have found more often than not, even in all of my engineering work and my analytical work, we actually collapse those really quickly. So trying to find the place to pull apart what is actually a fact and what is my explanation of those facts is much more challenging and requires a different kind of listening for, well, what has you say that? Because most people don't actually, even analysts, they're leading with the facts that mattered the most to them in a particular moment, right? So in all my work, when I was doing analytical work, yes, you led with data, but there was a lot more data than the data you presented. So you still made choices about the data you presented generally to make a case that you were trying to make. So really, how do you pull that apart and understand what is actually the way you're explaining something? And the reason for me that this is so important is our explanations are actually what drive the next action we're going to take. The data doesn't actually drive the action. How we explain that data is what how we're actually going to see a new possibility or not to make forward progress, to innovate, to problem solve together, to resolve relational differences, right? All of that comes from, well, how do I explain a particular thing more than just what are the facts around it?
Right. I think some of the ways that we see people use facts and data in a wasteful way are, I'm using it to poke holes in your argument so that I'm proving you're wrong and I'm right. That's wasteful, not valuable. And using facts and data as a way to have them assert your position rather than you assert your position. And we would consider that pretense if you're learning about the meter, but it's, you're just not even staking your claim in the conversation or in the relationship. It's using the data, hiding behind the data and the facts, and having them make the argument for you, also wasteful. So the other, you know, the other thing that's helpful in my mind often is that we're storytelling beings by nature. We make meaning out of the data, input, information that we take in every moment all the time. And we do that automatically quite often. And so if we're already meaning makers, we're already storytellers, I feel like this learning to do exactly what you were just talking about is learning how to leverage our natural capacity to tell a story and our tendency to tell a story, but channel it in service of value instead of having it limit what's possible or have it disconnect us from others and from what's possible. So, you know, I have this sort of visual that I think about is, okay, you have your explanation, even the one that is very tightly held about what's going on and what the story is. If you can label it as an explanation, it's like you get to then put it on the bookshelf. Okay, so that's one explanation on the bookshelf. What other explanations do I have that are possible in this, you know, situation that we're in? What's in the realm of possibility? Then you just put all the explanations available to you on the bookshelf. And then you get more explanations from other people and you keep putting them on the bookshelf. And now you have a library of explanations to choose from in that help. So what are the stories that help us and what are the stories that hurt us? This is true on an individual level. So you can practice this for yourself when you're worked up about a situation. You know, is what in this is getting me so worked up? What's important to me? What is true? Like what actually happened? What actually is occurring? What are the facts? And then what's helpful? What's helpful about my relationship to what's happening? And that, even if it's, you can't verify that that explanation is true, if it helps you move closer to the thing you care about or closer to the person who could contribute to the thing you care about, then it's helpful. So it's just about learning how to work with the way we operate as human beings rather than against it.
And I think working with it means accepting it in myself, not just, you know, it's true about other people. They get opinionated and defensive and right. They just don't learn. Because I think being able to catch in the moment that the speed of an opinion is faster than the speed of learning. As y'all know, we've asked people thousands and thousands of times around the world, what's the speed of an opinion? And people will tell us instant, you know, really fast. We say, okay, and how long does it take for someone to really understand an important point you're making? And we ask them, which one's faster, speed of opinion or speed of learning? We've never had anybody say anything other than speed of opinion's faster than speed of learning. So I've got to be able to take responsibility for, wait a minute, I'm going to have an irrationally rapid opinion. I will. Can I catch it and then do what you said, Emrose, where I stop, take a breath, release it momentarily, long enough to research, to understand, what are you seeing? What have you been in? What have you experienced that explains how come you're saying that? So I can see other people's explanations. And then we start to treat them like potential gold to mine. You know, mm-hmm. Which one helps, which one hurts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the Vitality Imperative, one of the chapters, I think it's on authenticity, we talk about some of these inventions that happened in the face of breakdown. You know, one of them was at 3M when they spilled something, one of the researchers on a tennis shoe, and it was stained and they couldn't get it off. And they thought, oh, what a mess this is. Because whatever they were thinking of as the use for that chemical, you know, this is terrible. It's now destroyed these shoes. Well, I can't remember her name, Peggy something, I think. But anyway, one of the research scientists got really interested in how come water wouldn't penetrate it. How come it became the basis for Scotchgard. Yeah, so it became this hugely useful product for many years, which now some people say is not as useful as it could be. And so but still it had its run. Post-it notes. It was a failed ink experiment, you know, where they were all messed up about that. I mean, failed adhesive experiment. That new adhesive just doesn't stick. You can just pull it right off. It doesn't stick. You know, so you had different explanations. You know, one person's was, this is a failed experiment. Another is, whoa, wait a minute. It doesn't stick, but it does restick. Wait a minute, let's talk about this. And so my immediate reaction could be based in this opinion. But if I can be slow enough to stop and breathe and do what you said, Emrose, and research you could be the post-it note to my failed experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting. We spend a lot of time with people around the world, and the number of people who say to me something to akin to, you know, I just think really fast. Mm. I just want to remind all of us think faster than any of us can speak. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this thing, Mick, is really, it sounds really simple to like hold, like catch yourself in that opinion. But the reality is our brain is sort of really quickly working on making sense of whatever somebody else is saying. And so some of this is, for me over the years, practically speaking, can I give my brain something more valuable to look for than what's wrong with your argument? Because as an engineer, I am trained to find what's wrong with an argument. What's wrong? There, I'm not alone in this. Lots, I found there are lots of people who are trained in a variety of professions, engineers, lawyers, doctors, hello to all of you, who we are trained to find the thing that's wrong. But if I, left to my own devices, that is where my brain is going to go. It has habituated to do that. It has been trained to do that. I, like I said, I both have a degree in it and worked in it. And so I have to actually be on the hunt for something else. And so what is there to learn here? Can I actually see a different possibility? For me, that's where I tend to go, is like, what else is possible if I really understand what this person is saying? But I do find that giving my brain something else to do, when we say listening to learn, what am I actually trying to learn about in this conversation, for me has been a useful practice. Because just saying listening to learn, well, I could just be learning what a jerk I think you are and getting more data for that.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Actually, for us, the evidence for learning is the evolution of your own point of view. And so, yeah, I say I'm learning. I'm learning that I was right about what's wrong with you. This addiction to being right and proving others wrong is a standardized compulsion in the human interaction. So the game is, can we catch it? Can we just notice it? Because mm-hmm. it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But there's something important, Robin, in what you just said, that, you know, those of you who are doctors, lawyers, engineers, who are skilled at finding flaw or weakness, there is a place that is of powerful value, and it's relative to what we are building together. Mm-hmm. So if there's something we are caring about and I see a danger, I'm much more likely to have you join me in that if I put it in the context of what we care about. This thing we are building could collapse, not work. So the finding of weakness or flaw can be powerful in service of what we're building. If finding it is in service of my view at the expense of yours,
yeah,
it's a misuse of a talent.
Right.
And this is so important, because people often get wrapped around the axle around, are we talking about happy, happy, joy, joy, only finding sort of the best solutions? No, we want to be able to have the conversation about the places where I'm either about to step into a ditch or have stepped into a ditch that I don't see. It's just, if you bring it up in the context of I'm wrong and you're right, it takes an inordinate amount of effort for me to listen to that. Mm-hmm. So it's not impossible, but it's going to take a lot of effort, and you might hit somebody on a great day and they can hear it, and you might hit somebody on a terrible day and they're not going to be able to hear that. But Mickey, to your point, if you put it in the context of, here's the thing we're building, here's the thing I know you care about, here's the thing we've said we care about, do you care about this ditch you're about to step into? Now I have a, there's a different listening for that in that moment. Mm-hmm. I think I've quoted him here before. We have a good friend, Michael Moon, who once said to me, because I raised an issue with him, and he said, Robin, that may be true, but it's not very helpful in this moment. And I think that this is part of what happens, is that we're listening for a thing and we're not putting it in the context of the moment, of why does it matter in this moment?
Right. Well, you know, I want to go back to something Mickey said about, he said the evolution of your point of view. That's very specific language. your opinion plays a role in the evolution of your opinion. So it's not that you've just now adopted somebody else's perspective at the cost of your own. It's what new understanding arises because I got to learn from yours. And we're all better for that if we can engage with it. I think that certainty is something for everyone to watch out for. Certainty likely is cutting you off from something new, from being available to others, from being available to new perspectives. You know, so many leaders and all the different top leadership skills and strategic imperatives and blah, blah, blah lists that get published at the beginning of the year talk about leaders have to deal with uncertainty. They have to deal with change and dynamic conditions. They have to be innovative thinkers. They have to be thinking at a system enterprise level. You don't get to do that if you can't do these things that we're talking about, or at least you're not going to do it as well as is possible if you can't do it this way. And it's just important to acknowledge that your opinion is still valid. We're not saying that your perspective is invalidated by engaging with another person. It's still important and true to you, and you can be compassionate about that.
Yeah. Am I so insecure that I'm unavailable to listen to another?
Right. And that's the thing, is it comes, certainty comes from fear, insecurity, defensiveness. Yeah. At least I think a lot of
times. And I think the crucial ingredient to this, I really like that you started this whole thing about, in that context, if it's the question, am I winning or what are we building? I just think, Bob Johansson, who's one of the founders of the Institute for the Future, you know, and they do these futurist predictions once every 10 years. I think they're close to their fifth decade. And his have been remarkably prescient, really extraordinary. And the last book of his, he's probably written one since then, that I read was called Leaders Make the Future, about what have they learned about the trends, where things are going. And he said that the most crucial aspect of leadership going forward is what he called a building mentality or a maker's mentality. Because he said that we have to build and grow things and connect others in the making. So the primary thing, he's saying the leadership skill is that builder mentality, to build and grow things and connect others in the making. That is what we need to have in place in order to be able to manage these petty opinions. So this thing about the act of leadership to clarify what we're building, we're adding Johansson to the credentials for our statements. That's what helps us catch what's not doing that. It helps me catch my irrationally rapid certainty.
I think the other thing that I watch out for myself, and I coach people about routinely, is just to notice what explanations stop a discussion or stop a dialogue. So you've heard me tell the story. I may have told it here before. I'm going to tell it again, which is we did work in a large hospital system years ago, and a strategic initiative that they were doing, somebody would almost always say, but there's a nursing shortage, which, as we know in this country, has been true for a number of years. Like, there just really are, accurately speaking, not as many nurses as we need to care for humans in hospital systems. So that was, it was an accurate data-based explanation, is that we have a nursing shortage. It just stopped every conversation because people would go, oh, you're right, nursing shortage, what are we going to do? And so I'm not saying that that's not a legitimate explanation. What we really coached the leaders in at the time was to lean into that, because what they tended to do was sort of sit back and want to either deflect it, power over it, or ignore the conversation, the comment altogether, as opposed to what. And Rose, you just said there's a nursing shortage. What had you mentioned it in this moment? What are you present to that had that matter right now? And why that question became really important is sometimes it was not enough labor. Sometimes it was that there was an emotional overload for the people you were talking to. The reason this matters is those are two very different problems to solve. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to solve not enough labor, well, we might, or is there work that we should be bifurcating? This is where I got the working at the top of your license. What's the top of the nursing license? Are there activities that nurses are doing that nurses shouldn't be doing, that orderlies should be doing, or housekeeping should be doing? If it's an emotional overload, that's going to send us in a very different direction in terms of what needs to happen. So yes, it might be some labor things, but it might look like very different support. And without having that conversation, you're totally skipping what could be possible in terms of the invention that needs to happen in order to move in the direction of your goal and finding new solutions.
That's a really good example too, that I think is practical and translates across a lot of systems, is capacity constraint, resource constraint. So, you know, I guess another one we could say is competing priorities. If you sit with the explanation that our priorities are in conflict with one another, how likely do you think it is that you're going to resolve the conflict between the priorities or figure out a path forward? Not as likely until somebody decides there's a different conversation to have. But I think that's helpful just so people can see the practical examples that we're talking about in organizations.
You know, I think there's two things here that are really important as we move at least toward the end of our conversation. One is that people think of, I'm having a fact-based conversation, or let's get accurate about this, in that context of combat. That's not why we care about accuracy. We care about accuracy as a method of discovery to help us build what we're building. Which means this thing about what are we building is a big darn deal. What Johansson calls the maker instinct, the people who build and grow and connect others in the making. So if you want to have accuracy serve value creation and not just be a form of combat, you have to constantly take care of what are we building. And cultivating Johansson's maker instinct, pardon me, Bob, maker instinct, as what it takes to build and grow and connect people to the making. Mm-hmm. So we want accuracy as an asset to building what we're building, rather than an asset to being right and proving others wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Another check is, where am I experiencing a lot of certainty that maybe I could widen my aperture? Where do I have an explanation that shuts down conversation? And where do I have an explanation that causes more disconnection than it causes connection? So where am I saying something that it's connected to the shutting down the conversation, but that causes people to get defensive or lean away from me rather than leaning into the conversation and wanting to contribute to it? I mean, that's just some conversational physics that'll give you a hint as to where you might be living with an explanation that either is not helping or is hurting. So we would invite you to just be a little bit exploratory. Look at the bookshelf. What else is available to you? And maybe ask some other people for their perspective. So any other last things that you'd love to leave people with about practicing accuracy?
Well, you all know that I have for a number of years used as a way to unstick myself and help others who are stuck is the phrase, well, that's an explanation. So it's not mm-hmm. that the explanation's wrong or not valid. It's an explanation. Is there another that we find attractive, compelling, valuable in terms of moving us forward? So for me, it's an explanation that sort of has me think about the facts that I've been presented with or the place that we're moving towards and see what else might help us or help the conversation that we're in.
Yeah. To build on that, I also often, if I'm trying to work through something in conversation with other people, often I'll say, well, the explanation I'm currently sitting with is ... So it's not, well, this is what's happening.
Right.
This is the explanation I currently have. And then it qualifies it as an explanation for the other people that are listening to me in that conversation. See, right. That's what I'm talking about. It invites people into the conversation. Yeah,
that's right.
Rather than pushing them out of it.
Yeah, it's why we say hold your explanations lightly rather than in a death grip.
Right.
Yeah.
And this alludes to something we said before, but just as part of the what to be thinking at the end, I do think one of the most productive development pathways for leadership is to be able to take a set of facts and explain it in 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 ways. Like, this is what I think these facts mean. This, and then rank them in terms of their value to what you're building. Because if people do that, if they actually see it, we have 5 different ways we could explain this. And I can actually see those 2 hurt us. Those 2 doesn't even help us. But that one gives us something to discuss. Let's get these people in here and let's go after that. So cultivating our ability to see the difference between the power of explanations to move us forward, that is a leadership attribute that is woefully under-practiced.
Mm-hmm. And as Mickey would say. Well, with that, thanks for coming along with us on this conversation. And we will see you next time. We may or may not end up doing a deep dive into authenticity to keep building on this so that it's what does accuracy then afford you in terms of the value you can cause. So until then, be well. Adios.
Thanks, everybody.
This episode was produced by Guy Connolly. Original artwork is by Dana Buckingham, and music is by a cast of characters. Special thanks to Conversant's extended community, who inspire the continued evolution of our work and stand with us in our commitment to change leadership, business, and the world through conversation. You can learn more about Conversant at www.conversant.com.
On Connection is created and produced by the members of Conversant. Awakening the world to the power and joy of authentic human connection, we set a new standard for leadership that produces meaningful, enduring impact.
Until next time.